We're going to have a great show.
Yes. Yay.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 95 for the week of November 15th, 2015.
So subdued.
I am embarrassing mitten strings, David T. Cole, and I'm here with hot glued hemline, Sarah D. Bunting.
We only had one day.
Disappointed Heidi Klum fan, Joe Reed.
Hannah Davis, awesome.
Hidden zipper tar, Ariano.
Peekaboo.
And long-suffering mood employee, Stephanie Kangro.
This fabric is $50 a yard.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast, Stephanie Kangro.
Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you. Hi, guys.
Good to have you back.
Yay!
For your first outing with Joe Reed back on the panel, and we were having you on this week because our lead topic is a show that you are covering for us at previously.tv, Project Runway Junior. The premiere aired on Thursday, and I'm very curious to know how people thought it was versus the new one. First of all, did anyone watch Threads other than me?
The UK post-apocalyptic horror show miniseries from the 80s? I watched it. The baby at the end was deformed.
Much
spoiler.
More interesting iteration of Runway.
Yeah.
No, I did. I got like 10 minutes into it and was like, I don't know why this is so boring, but it is, and I gotta go.
Yeah, I think the problem with Threads was that the kids were like notably
mutated.
Much younger. They were not mutated, as in the other thing that's called Threads.
I'm not gonna drop this line, by the way.
I'm gonna stop talking about it in a second, so you're gonna have to. But yeah, they were slightly too young, so it was like, you know, it's impossible to think that they're going to even get a halfway decent critique, but these ones are actual teenagers and I kind of like them. What did everyone else think?
Can I just go first?
Because yeah,
I got
go
one thing
ahead,
to
Dave.
Say and then I'm going to drop out.
Yes.
Which is this. This is just another episode, another season of Project Runway. There is no difference except the kids are a little younger. I feel like they're setting them up for something mean. But otherwise, I felt like this show didn't feel any different from a regular season of Project Runway.
Huh.
Well, what's the youngest age of a cast member of Real Project Runway we've ever had? We've had like 18, 19-year-olds, right?
Yeah, they're butting up against each other. The lower limit of one and the upper limit of the
I
other.
I can't remember who the youngest I remember seeing on actual show.
I think Siriano at the time, Christian Siriano,
like
who won.
21?
Yeah,
like
he was like 20 or 21 when filming started.
Yeah.
And was living like under an ironing board.
Yeah.
And just finished at FIT, maybe.
Yeah. So these kids are like a couple years away, all the 16-year-olds at least, a couple years away from being able to go to like fashion school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and if you watch the last season of Project Runway Senior, like Blake Patterson did not seem that much older than some of these kids.
And I don't necessarily think that's a negative. It's just interesting. I think you're right, Tara, in that these would be closer to the level of designer who you would take as like a greenhorn on regular Project Runway, but like able to sort of like swing with the big kids a little bit.
Well,
so it doesn't like, it's not sort of like how MasterChef Junior. Sometimes to me, I'm just like, where do they get these kids? You're like, these kids, I'm just sort of like, I can see how a life that's not necessarily so outside the norm of American life could produce a child like this
sure.
at that age.
Right.
So it's less jarring for me.
Yeah. I'm glad that you brought up Blake, whoever did, because I was thinking while I was watching these kids, like the mannerisms on these like teens and tweens that are very childlike is acceptable when there's a whole passel of them. When there's just one or two acting like that in regular Project Runway, I really want to just punch them dead, frankly.
Yeah.
But the kids are really endearing, I thought. What did Stephanie you think?
I agree with all of that, but I think they casted extremely well because they do have a 13-year-old. Maya is 13, which
yeah.
is seemingly absurdly young, but she's pretty mature, I feel, for her age. And her garment was my actual favorite of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And she was given, I feel, less camera time maybe than some of the others, though, you know, it goes up and down every week based on who's doing terribly and who's doing really well. They showed the small clip of her not understanding a medium-sized word that Tim Gunn used, which was kind of funny. But I think they cast it extremely well, and they're also editing it pretty well because I think some of the designers, like Matt, who I think was on an episode of Threads, would generally annoy me if the camera and focus was on him a little bit longer, but they cut him or cut his appearances so that they were just like nice little accents as opposed to a main focus.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. What about Tim is coming off a very rough season for him with the public. And I saw a couple people tweeting that they thought this was a better use of Tim because it lets him be more of an educator. Sarah, you've been very hard on Tim Gunn in the just ended season of Project Runway. What did you think with that regard?
Well, it's early yet. And I think the issue lately is that he's really started to believe his own press after 10 or 15 years of doing this. And yeah. When it's early on in the season and he hasn't really had a chance to like get in a lane with a favorite or, you know, on the swap nil tip, someone that he just has decided, you know, isn't living life according to Tim Gunn. What concerns me a little bit is that there was, I mean, on Under the Gun, which I think no one else stuck out until the end, that's when it really started to curdle with him. For me, I think he was fine in this episode, but I also think that the sort of secret genius of these kids shows generally, and I'll be talking a little bit about MasterChef Junior in this regard later in the show, is that because they are trying very hard to make it this like safe environment, I guess. It's not quite the right word, but you know,
less harsh kind of.
Yeah, they're trying to encourage the kids, and also they cast kids who are not going to break each other down.
Yeah.
That the drama really comes from where drama should come from in competition reality shows, which is the skill that they're there to compete in.
Right.
That yeah. There's less, I mean, MasterChef Junior is like edited just to like tweak a nose hair from my nostril and force me to cry every time, and it's very effective and I respect that, but this seems like generally a good bunch of kids, but also they're not looking to like inter designer drama, like the whatever mean girling of Ashley, whatever you feel about what went down there and blah blah on the reunion, like I think that's not somewhere they're willing to go on a show with like minor children on it. And I think that's really good for the show because it forces it to stick to its knitting, as it were.
Agree.
They seem to have cast less fragile kids than you might see on like their 5 years older counterparts in shows where you could see like the girl who got eliminated was not like, she took that really well. She took it, you know, like a well-adjusted champ who was just sort of like, you know, fairly good perspective about it. She wasn't breaking down crying or anything like that.
But the other like kids were.
Have a problem of casting a 20-year-old in, you know, who would react that way.
Yeah. I did like how emotional the other kids got too. That's also like MasterChef Junior.
Well, that was sweet and just sort of, you know,
That is sweet.
That was nice.
I think they found the sweet spot of ages where they're not trying to do this to make a name for themselves, where they kind of think, that they can outsmart producers or something. Like, I'm going to go on and be this crazy character. And, you know, whereas you might get that with like a 20, 21-year-old.
Yeah.
These kids are, I mean, they're all, for the most part, still in high school. I mean, I think some are in middle school even. But so they're kind of, I think, more of a summer camp mentality, which is really sweet to watch, how they kind of form friendships too, just like hanging out in the sewing room or something and, you know, bonding over something not working right.
Yeah.
Well, and it's not like they couldn't have cast for that type of person too, because if you've watched even like a little bit, and I've watched the bare minimum of like vlogs out there and YouTube stuff, like there are kids out there who are in the mentality of like, this is what I need to do to get myself famous. So like, props to the casting for avoiding that type seemingly so far.
Yeah, they don't seem like they're trying to be too cool either. And I love the summer camp analogy. That's a great way to phrase it, Stephanie, because my other thought was like having all these kids brought together with the common interest. And even if their backgrounds were very different and that they had an obsession that maybe like no one else they personally know shares. Basically, I'm saying this might have been the first time some of these gay kids ever met another gay kid. And that was also really touching to me.
The same thing. It was
like Jackson and his cows. And I was like, son, stay off the farm.
So happy he got off a farm for a while.
And his dress seemed like it was going to be really bad. It seemed like a really bad idea in the workroom when he was talking to Tim Gunn about like, this side's going to be gray and this side's going to be color and blah, blah, blah. But it turned out really well, I thought.
It did.
I would have worn that. Yeah.
It was really cute.
What were we going to say, Dave?
I was going to say the stunt casting of the kid from Glee was a little much.
Dave is referring to Matt, I believe.
Oh, and the other kid from Glee. And the other kid from Glee. What did we think of the judging comparatively? I really like this whole panel.
Yeah, I thought they were solid.
I'm not a Kelly Osbourne fan, but I thought she was fine in this, so yeah.
Yeah, she was funny.
I love Kelly Osbourne.
Oh, rumble.
fight,
sorry.
Fight.
No, I'm just kidding. She was funny. I'm like neutral on her, but her her joke about the jumpsuit saying that you can get front back wedgie and front wedgie is like, well, that's a diplomatic way to put it when some of these are minor children. We know what you mean, but funny.
And I think she's had those wardrobe problems in the past, which is why she's probably willing to go on record about calling them out about a specific type of garment. Like, oh, I've tried to wear that and it doesn't work,
yeah.
Which is why I appreciate her perspective on it.
Yeah, and I thought the judging was really good. But for the same reason that, Sarah, that you were describing of like how these kid shows go, which is they were actually trying to be constructive even with the negative critiques without being like mean and trying to gain points like Nina Garcia style.
What is Kelly Osbourne on? I know she's like hosted.
She was on Fashion Police, yeah. But okay. Now it's over, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right. She has experience doing this. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she seemed to know what she was talking about. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I liked the dynamic that Christian Siriano had with the kids too, where it was a little bit sort of older brothery, and that was a level that I didn't think he would have been capable of.
Yeah.
So it made me really like him a lot more. I'm sort of sometimes hot and cold on him. I generally like him, but it made me really like him in this.
Yeah. What did you?
I think he has matured. I think we forget that he's, you know, what was it, like 10 years ago?
I was going to say, it's been about 10 years, yeah.
He still seems very youthful and is still obviously cutting edge in his styles. But, like, you sort of still have this memory, this, like, sense memory of him as being, like, kind of a bitch sometimes.
Yeah.
And he was very direct and didn't sugarcoat things, but he wasn't mean. Like, he was a very good Zach Posen Jr. into it.
Yeah.
One thing that Stephanie called out in her post was that this is an exact replay of a challenge that they do all the time on the regular show, on the grown-up show. But I also thought it was kind of mean to make them, like, to say that their inspiration was supposed to be New York and then have them, like, take pictures from a rooftop. Because I feel like everyone is going to have the same inspiration, and so many of them did, which is like, well, I was inspired by the skyline.
Traffic
like
patterns.
Right, yeah. What else are you going to see from that high up? I thought that was kind of unfair.
No hobo vomit. From that perspective.
It also made me think how young these kids must have been when Jay McCarroll designed his Chrysler Building dress, and then I wanted to crawl into a hole and just cry for a while.
Yeah. Well, when Sammy talked about designing for her gown for an older woman and then specified that it was 30-year-old, I just facepalmed so hard.
They can't help it.
No matter what, she was just not winning it from there on for me.
I was turning into Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis at the end of Beetlejuice at that point. Shriveling up in my wedding attire.
Stephanie, do you you've already seen ahead to the second episode, I think, or at least you may shortly. Do you have, without giving any spoilers, do you have any very, very early picks of who you think might win this season?
Might win this season? I don't know. I do dislike Petey already, which maybe is a little harsh.
What a monster.
I mean, she's very talented. She does know what she's doing around the workroom. Absolutely. She has a point of view. I just don't enjoy it particularly. It's not something I would wear. Jackson, as much as he kind of annoys me on camera a little bit, and I think he over-talks about designing for, you know, BA women, badass women, as he calls them. I just think it's kind of cute that he doesn't like to say the phrase badass a lot. He has some pretty interesting designs that when he talks about, like the dress, you know, one side being black and white, one side being colorful, they play out much better visually than he describes them verbally. So I think he's interesting to watch.
Okay. Anyone else? Early picks?
I have in my notes the phrase Samantha seems cool as heck, and now I can't remember who Samantha was. But
she's the one who won. She did this this sort of streetwear look of the blouse, the cropped blouse, and the wide leg jeans.
Okay, her. She does seem cool as heck. I like her a lot.
I love her.
I liked who was the kid that did the he was like doing the rap thing while he was ripping the fabric. It was like the scratching on
Zachary,
the
record. Stephanie's bestie.
Oh my gosh. I like him. He reminds me of the one I wanted to win, season 13, Cowie.
I might not have watched that season.
I don't remember. Sorry.
Polynesian gentlemen.
They fall out of my head as soon as the season ends.
Yeah.
So what are the challenges that they're going to do differently, do you think, now that there's kids doing it? Like, obviously, they're going to have one where they do stuff for their parents.
Yeah.
Well, the one where they have to use dildos to make a skirt, that's probably out.
Well,
they should have really paired that with a New York inspiration one, I feel like. I think they're going to just stick to pulling challenges from past seasons and kind of making them age appropriate. That's the sense I got.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's interesting to compare and contrast them in that sense, but I don't think they're going to knock any, you know, surprises out of the park in terms of what they come up with.
It's funny when you think of how many actual Project Runway challenges did seem child appropriate. Like, oh, they could go to the M&M store. Oh, wait, they've already done that. Oh, they could go to Toys R Us. Oh, wait, they've already done that.
They could bring them to a vintage store and, oh, wait, they did that.
Yeah.
At Red Robin.
Yum.
Well,
how do you feel about future Mrs. Derek Jeter? She's fine.
I wish she would stop sticking her tongue out between her teeth. And that goes for you also, Matt. But other than that, I thought she was fine. She seems warm and friendly and nice. Like, she's a good fit for the kids. And I thought it was weird that her voice, to me, sounds exactly like Heidi Klum's, except with an American accent.
Yeah, it really does. You're right.
As my intro suggested, I did sense a palpable thing among the kids where she walked out and they're like, oh, not Heidi. Okay, she's fine. She's good. I'll talk myself into her. She's whatever.
I feel like they would know who she is, though.
Sure, yeah. But I think if they were, fans of the show, they would, you know, obviously want... Like, they were like, Tim Gunn, I know him.
Did anyone else watch the jewelry one?
I watched the accessories-only one? I watched a couple.
I didn't.
Who was the stiff they had hosting that? Angela someone?
Oh.
I would say Angela Davis, but that would really be a very different show. I would watch that, too.
We should do a list or a mini or something on the great stiff hosts of Bravo Lifetime-type reality shows.
Oh, yeah.
We've had quite the array of them.
Mrs. Matthew McConaughey on The Hair Show. Oof.
Oh, yes! What was it? Camilla Alves? Was that
Alves?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to keep watching. I thought this was fun.
Yeah, it was very cute. I enjoyed it.
And Stephanie has to.
I'll definitely be watching.
You gotta.
So follow her coverage at previously.tv.
That's what the money is for.
All right, everybody. It's time to go around the dial. Everybody's bringing something on TV to the table. Tara, you're first.
Well, Dave and I flew to England this week and sampled a couple of shows that are airing over there. Peep Show is back for its 9th and final season. This is a show that we have talked about. Did we do it for the canon in this or in Mark 1?
Mark 1, I think.
Yeah. Maybe. Yes, right. We did that Mitchell and Webb look for Mark 2. Anyway, Robert Webb and David Mitchell are back. They're still playing their same characters. They still have not grown, even though the show has been running for 10 years. In the end of the season 8 finale, there was a big split between the guys over a girl that they both liked. And now, as we rejoin them, they have not seen each other in 6 months, and it's super awkward. And Mark has a new roommate, and they have to get rid of him, and everything that happens is horrible. And it will tickle all of your, like, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Last Man on Earth, awkward, calm, funny bones, I feel like. At a certain point, the roommate has to fall asleep in a sleeping bag that he's, like, zipped all the way up around him.
But the difference
and that only
Peep
makes it easier for them to transport him elsewhere, like, into the elevator against his will.
I think Peep Show has his cake and eats it, too, in that regards, though, because it is, like, it has that awkward comedy vibe to it, but it's also, like, genuinely funny stuff going on, too, where
for
it's,
sure.
like, something like Last Man on Earth, I think it, like, sort of puts all its cards into, you know, like, puts all its coins. What am I trying to think of? God damn it, Dave.
All its coins in
eggs,
one coin.
All its eggs into one chicken. God damn it. You know what I mean? It's just existing
house
on that one.
Environment.
Hey.
It was a very funny episode. I was really glad it was back. It started a little bit slow, and then it really, really picked up by the end. And these two are still hilarious together. They've been, like, doing comedy since they were in college, and it shows. They are an awesome sketch comedy team and comedy acting team as well. And we also watched the first episode of London Spy, a.k.a. the Ben Whishaw is a Gay Spy show.
No!
Except he's not the spy. I thought he was. He's dating a spy, which is what we found out in the first episode, which was...
That's even cooler.
Super good. It's really good. If you can get on a flight, I really recommend it. Dave, what did you think?
What a generic title.
It is. It's a bad title.
Terrible title. It was interesting. I thought it was kind of slow.
What was the other one he was in, like, 10 years ago? It was called Criminal Justice. Like, narrow it down.
Also, at the Toronto Film Festival this year, there were two films. One was called London Road, and one was called London Field. So,
oh, dear.
Figure your shit out. because we need more.
British topography series continues unabated.
Yeah, seriously.
It was fine. I thought it was a little slow, but the last third really picks up and it made it quite interesting. I realized they were building something up for a limited British series. I thought the first episode ran a little slow.
Yeah, but, it's only five episodes, I think. But also Jim Broadbent is in it.
I was confused because I just assumed that Ben was the spy just because he's the star, right? And he's called London Spy. For the first few minutes, I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. He doesn't seem like a spy at all. And I thought Jim Broadbent was his handler, you know?
Yeah,
and
all that's this. How it seems.
Yeah,
it's I was like, a little misleading.
I see. I'm just stupid. So
with that scenario, they had the spy who loved me right there. Like, why not just have that your title?
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it was good.
The spy who didn't love me after all.
Stephanie.
Okay, so I am bringing The Man in the High Castle to the dial this week. It's an original Amazon series that will premiere on the 20th of this month being November, if you're listening on time. It is based on a 1962 novel by Philip K. Dick, which is just a really fun name to pronounce. I missed the pilot when Amazon released it last year or the very early beginning of this year, as they do. But recently, all of the promotion for it caught my attention. It's kind of propaganda-filled imagery that looks really, really beautiful. It's well done. And so I went back and I watched the pilot, and it's interesting. So the plot basically is kind of what would happen if America lost World War II. The show is set in 1962, and America is now.
Did we bring this as a will Dave hate this?
Yeah,
yeah. We've talked about it a little bit before. I think when the pilot first came out. Yeah.
Does Dave hate this?
No, I love. No, this is so a Dave show. But yeah, continue.
Awesome.
I'll chime in for sure.
Cool. So the United States is partitioned into the Pacific States of America, which is controlled by Japan. There's a neutral zone in the Rocky Mountains, which is just kind of shady. You don't really know what's going on there, except you get the feeling it's kind of dangerous to visit. And then there's a Nazi puppet state called the Great Nazi Reich on the East Coast. Like I said, stylistically, as with the promotion for it, everything's incredibly beautiful. Color-wise, everything's a sort of muted gray tone, and it feels like you're watching an old movie, but everything is slightly twisted in subtle ways. Not subtle is the swastikas are kind of everywhere, and they're fairly obvious.
Well, you have to understand about Nazis. Exactly. Yeah. They're very evil and very good at branding.
Yes. Then there are like more subtle things, like at one point you see just like a regular, you know, jet plane, except, and it looks period appropriate, except it has really large engines on it. And then you hear the characters talk about advances in German engineering. And so it kind of gives you a visual sense of, you know, what could be. And without giving too much away from the pilot, the story follows Joe Blake, who's a young 20-something in New York, as he joins this sort of American resistance that's going on. And then Juliana Crane, who's growing up in the Pacific area states, I guess, kind of somewhere along the California coast. And she is kind of lured into the neutral zone by some family mystery where they meet and... I'm going to stop talking about the plot because that's where the big twists come in.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed the show a lot. I thought the set design and just, you know, the design in general was great. They do a couple overreaches with the special effects, but otherwise I think they nailed that part of it. The interesting thing, the smart move they made is in the book or the short story, the Man in a High Castle is, he writes a book and it's not a film. So it was kind of smart that they, translated that in the TV show where it's a film instead of a book, so they can do everything visually. That was a good call. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Like, it's going to be interesting to see how they add material to what's happening in the book, because they're going to make a series out of a short story. They've used up most of the material from the book, a good chunk of it anyway. So it's going to be interesting. Do we have access to season one yet? Are they doing that?
No.
No.
It premieres on, I don't know, I mean, I don't know about
Amazon does everything at once now too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
But between that and Between that and Jessica Jones both launching on November 20th. It's going to be a lot of time for people to, a lot of shows for people to sneak away from their families to watch during Thanksgiving this year.
Yeah.
Although I really think Dan, my husband, really liked the pilot of The Man in the High Castle. And he was like, this is actually one of those shows that, like, I'm sure all of you have this experience where at the holidays, your older relatives are like, well, what's good that I
totally.
Your primary view of Blue Bloods. Oh, that might upset them, though. It can be a little difficult to, like, pick a lane for them, but this is good, like, you know, this is good to tell your uncle to watch.
Servicey.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Awesome.
We're here to help.
Joe.
I almost said it again. How to Get Away with Murder, which I always see the acronym and want to say How to Get Away with Your Mother because it looks different show, different show.
Better show.
It is coming up on its fall finale. All the Shondaland shows are having a fall finale this coming Thursday. The How to Get Away with Murder one, it was promising you. You'll finally find out who shot Annalise because that's the flash forward they've been going to all this season. As the season began, I thought it had all the ingredients of me of being a show that I was going to fall away from and drop just because they were like, oh, they're just doing the same thing from the first season over again with the same blue-tinged flash forward and same kind of problems that they had. But the season has really, I think, sorted itself out for me to the point where it's my favorite of those Thursday night shows, and I generally think all three of them are having a good season this year. But it might be just sort of a war of attrition that after however many episodes have aired, I'm finally figuring out what the plot is with the two siblings that they're defending from murder charges throughout the whole thing. But whatever it is, I'm on board. It's really good. Fall finale is this Thursday. The only thing I am begging them, and I know it's already like in the can or whatever, but please, please, please don't have the person who shot Annalise be Famke Janssen's obsessed lesbian character. They've actually like done a good job with that character of introducing her as sort of this past fling that Annalise had, and it's always sort of twisty to tell how much Annalise is into it because Viola Davis always plays her with these sort of multiple layers of seriousness. But the last time they brought back Famke Janssen's character, and she was there for a couple episodes and then gone, and then she came back and now she's gone again, and I was just like, shit, this has all the ingredients of like the jilted, overly invested, murderous lesbian
basic like, instinct it up. Yeah.
And you would think that they would know better, but like you can't always trust people, and especially like, you know what I mean? So it's just like I'm crossing my fingers and I'm holding my breath. Because the other thing is, it's not just that it's a lesbian character, it's Famke Janssen. Like she's always a threat to be the killer. So like maybe those two ingredients were too much for them to resist.
It's her bone structure. It really lends itself to evil murder? Duplicitous murder. Yeah.
But come on, guys, she wouldn't shoot Annalise. She would choke her out with her thighs like Xenia Onatopp.
Really?
So let me ask you, Joe. So this show, season one, they solved the murder, and then like each season, a new murder, a new lesson on how to get away with murder. Is that what they're doing?
Well, the stuff this season has sort of sprung from the loose ends from the first season, so it's not quite so tidy.
Right.
But it did feel like when they first showed that new flash forward, it was like, oh, okay, here again, it's another murder we see.
Right. Yeah.
But they've added elements. There are now multiple dead bodies because you gotta, you know, step up your game. It's not just good enough to have one, you know, attempted murder.
Yeah, the higher concept the show, the much harder it is to like generate that second season after you do it. And there's a graveyard of TV shows that just couldn't pull it off. So it's nice.
As it were.
And they've managed to make a good two out of the four dumb students actually interesting, in my opinion. So it's better than what they were batting early on.
Very good. Sarah.
MasterChef Junior. I thought I wouldn't get sucked in. Oh my God, these kids. This show. I don't even like kids or MasterChef Senior anymore. And yet, this show, like, there's so much filler that you can sort of fast forward through once you know the rhythms of the show and how they always cut to commercial and then re-air the last 5 minutes. And then there's a lot of like, we're going to dump frosting on Gordon and Graham, and the kids are going to way over laugh at that because they're simple in addition to being 8 to 13 years old. It's not that funny. Yeah. But then they're like really cute to each other. It's really amazing to watch these kids using a knife as big as they are to like speed dice garlic.
Yeah.
And Gordon Ramsay is perfect with them. It is adorable. every time we'll just like watch it to have something on while we're eating lunch or something. And then my husband will look over and I'm like, sort of, I have my hand like folded over and he's like, are you crying? I'm like, no, you're crying. Yes, I'm crying.
He's one of those people who should only work with kids, right?
Yeah.
Because he's, I find him so overbearing and like shticky with adults.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's actually not really his personality at all. Like, I think that was probably
tell,
like
he's straining to like play it up with the adult.
And the real problem is that like he's left a legacy of like now everybody apes him. Like Bar Rescue has basically their Gordon Ramsay character who acts just like him. So that's become like the template for all these kind of shows, like the, you know, the fix it shows that he does and all the sort of stuff. So it's like, you know, it'd be nice if he actually showed a human side and that other shows can follow suit, because it gets really tiresome after a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that this is so seemingly off brand. It was really very effective. And, but like all the judges, I sort of liked it better when Joe Bastianich was on both of them, because I don't like Christina Tosi really at all. But Joe was like so unrelentingly awkward with the kids. He has kids. Like, I just, I'm like, did you never talk to your children? Did you just like speak using spoon semaphore? You're so weird. You'd be like, how's it going, big guy? You're like, where did you learn to talk to children? 50s shows?
Champ. Little Chief.
That, but Chris, yeah, exactly. Like, English lessons. But Christina Tosi is really good with them. It's so superior to the senior counterpart. I'd recommend watching it, except the end, like, it's so brutal every week because they send two home and then all the other kids are crying and hugging them. And they're like, you're going to be an awesome chef. And my husband is completely making fun of me for crying into a feline while this is going on. But it's a good time. It's successful manipulation. I have to admire the build of it. It's extremely effective. Well done, Fox.
All right, wrapping us up, briefly talk about Into the Badlands, which has aired, hasn't aired yet.
It airs, we're recording this on Sunday, so it's airing tonight.
All right, and you guys did a talk it out on the site.
Yeah, we did.
Which I think the takeaway was not for you.
Yeah.
The fight scenes were good, but otherwise the show takes itself too seriously.
Yes.
And doesn't really have the gravitas to get away with that.
Correct.
Like other shows could say.
That's an excellent summary, Dave.
Yeah. So it's sort of like, to me, it's sort of like The Matrix.
Yeah.
That The Matrix didn't have a lot of humor in it, but it got away with it. You know what I mean?
Like,
it
was
a drastic understatement. In fact, might be the understatement of the year. I know it's still only November, but it's up there.
Yeah.
And you're right. It shares that trait with Walking Dead, which is just like it really could use a little, you know, a laugh here or there, or a wink at least, and it doesn't do that.
Yeah.
But the fight scenes in this show are fucking
awesome.
They
are really good.
Really good.
We talked about that. They're shot well and they're edited well. So often in like action movies now that have fighting, like you can't, there is so many quick cuts because they're all disguising how they're, you know, all bullshit and stuff.
It's all
you
Bourne,
can't even
Bourne
see
supremacy
what's happening.
Style.
Yeah, but here, like, they step back and show you from multiple angles, like from above even. It's really cool. And the second episode even has better fight scenes because those are the ones that are fighting with ladies.
Yeah, there's a good scene.
And there's also there's a couple of like visual sort of wink and nods to tropes of kung fu, which is that the bad guys always line up in this like orderly circle.
Yeah.
But then they sort of subverted that. I mean, I think the cast is like maybe not capable of doing humor anyway, except the lead who is really great. I like him, but he's kind of, I don't know, he's stuck in this bombastic story.
Yeah. They really need to like take a step back and figure out how to add that, because that is the missing element, and nobody's doing a good enough job in the show to get away with what they're trying to set up in the world, you know. And also in the setup for the world, like, it's so like, okay, this is our world, you're just gonna have to deal with it, that it seems weird that they also couldn't like inject some levity into the situation. Like the opening intro, and this isn't a big spoiler, but the opening intro is basically like this, a narration voiceover or something like that. It's like, and then everybody decided guns were outlawed. Okay, everybody just went along with that because of reasons. And like okay, there's a struggle between all these warlords and nobody thinks, I'm going to be the one that uses guns and I'm going to win. Nope.
Well, maybe that's the season finale.
Perhaps, but it was just sort of like, if they can set up that world where that you know, that level of, you know, acceptance is there. I think they could get away with actually like injecting some humor in it. But the fight scenes were amazing.
If you watch something like Iron Man, which they had a marathon of it on last night that we got sucked into.
Yeah.
Like that they find the humor in almost every situation in that whole franchise or mm-hmm. premise. And then Don Cheadle's like, get a roof when they're making out on the roof. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not that serious. Like, yeah, he's saving the world, but like put a laugh in there, please.
Basically this series capable, though, I think. It's a Jackie Chan film without Jackie Chan in it.
Yeah.
Like it has elements of a fun martial arts movie and really well choreographed fight scenes and interesting premises and locations for those fights. Mm-hmm. But they just need like to get to Jackie Chan, 1980 Jackie Chan's that shit up.
Well, and they know how to do it. As I said in my post, the creators of the show, Miles Miller and Alfred Guff, formerly of Smallville, but they also wrote the Shanghai Noon and Shanghai Nights movies, which not great movies, but at least
Jackie Chan I'm referring to. I'm talking more Drunken Master 2.
But you know what I'm saying? Like they know how to do that kind of action comedy hybrid.
Yeah.
Like there's,
because it reminded me of,
and even if it's not funny, Jackie Chan at least takes some joy as his characters and how well he can fight. Whereas this guy sort of seems like, I am burdened by my ability to articulate limbs. Like, fuck that. That's awesome. Be happy.
Yeah. It's like the code of the world is so depressing and everybody just feels like they have to follow it, you know, and they just can't break out of it. Maybe they will, but two episodes in, it's not happening yet. Anyways. All right. So the other one I want to talk about is With Bob and David, the not Mr. Show and Mr. Show follow-up on Netflix, which basically I don't want to say this. It is a, it picks up where season three of Mr. Show left off, which is not nearly as good as season one and two of Mr. Show, but it feels like it's about on par with season three where they started to sort of like, their hit and miss ratio sort of started to even out.
Yeah. Still good.
There was some good stuff. There were some like 5-7 minute skits that were like, all right, you know, and Mr. Show for me is like not the kind of show where you don't laugh for 6 or 7 minutes, but I found a couple of the episodes in the revival that happens. But, you know, I think it's on par with season three on HBO.
If there's only 4 episodes, if you liked Mr. Show, you're going to watch
six.
Them. No, there's 4 plus a special.
Oh, okay.
The special is like a making of kind of thing.
Anyways, but it's fine. I would like to see more. I feel like they maybe are just getting their legs back, you know?
Well, I read some of the interviews that they did around the revival, and apparently like they had 3 months that they could fit it in around all their schedules. And like a month of that was taken up with negotiations over like their deal and stuff.
Right.
So it was supposed to be more, but they like literally ran out of time. So the hope is that they will do a longer season if this one does well, which I'm sure it'll do fine for Netflix purposes.
I'll get it. I got it. Hi. Hello. Yes. Yep. No, just get into it now. Okay. Yep. We'll let you know if it wins or not. I couldn't find the clip, but thanks, phone call. It is time for the canon. this week, Stephanie is bringing us something. Take it away, Stephanie.
Yes. So this week I am bringing, and take it with a grain of salt, but I am bringing The Indians in the Lobby, which is season 3, episode 8 of The West Wing. It falls into the extremely limited, quote unquote, Thanksgiving episode category of TV shows, which is what I knew I wanted to present from. And I ended up selecting this specific episode because I think it's a great example of both everything The West Wing does well in terms of the sometimes more absurdist rhythm of the show. This is the episode where President Bartlett calls the Butterball hotline and infamously improvises with customer service, as well as the chemistry of the cast and the sort of more preachy morality that we all know Sorkin does so well, or at least just his trademark. Obviously, given the now wildly offensive title, The Indians in the Lobby, most of that morality is kind of outdated, making it sort of a perfect example of the time period that the show was made in as well. This is all supposed to be from the, you know, the kind of leftist perspective, but it's really only CJ's character who holds up to those standards when you're watching it now, as she tries to help said Indians who are actually literally in the lobby. While some of the dialogue now plays out like a junior GOP debate, especially in the subplot where Josh is running around continually restating that Rome is in fact in Italy, which always seems to surprise him. Ron Silver also guest stars in this episode as Bruno Gianelli, one of the president's re-election campaign figures. And I always find his character to be sort of sleazy and interesting because he always kind of pushes the main cast out of their comfort zone, since he's more willing to play actual politics realistically and as kind of a game, compared to a lot of the altruism that the Bartlett staff usually, you know, spends the whole episode agonizing over. The episode starts and everyone is already annoyed with President Bartlett because he's been obsessing over Thanksgiving since his family's going to be at Camp David instead of his family farm. So he's been spending his time by boring his entire staff complaining about it and talking about how he bases turkey. And that is not a euphemism, as you'll hear in this clip.
Abby didn't want to schlep to New Hampshire. Schlepping in a 747. It's not like we were going to have to carry our own bags or anything, but I do not argue. Were we talking about something?
I don't know, sir. When I came in here back in the late 50s, there was a purpose to it, but then one thing led to another, and I blacked out. I mean, I can hang in there with the best of them, sir, but somewhere during the discussion of anise and coriander and the other 15 spices you like to use to baste a turkey, I simply lost consciousness.
So being already in a grumpy mood, President Bartlett dismisses CJ after that outburst. I always enjoy when Martin Sheen is kind of sort of pitted against the rest of his staff. When the president's obsessing over something kind of minute, because it sets up a nice baseline for the rest of the staff, to sort of quip about in their daily interactions, which is what I think is always one of the more enjoyable aspects of the show's dialogue, how they kind of have to work around the verbal gag. And so once CJ happily escapes the Oval Office, she immediately finds Josh waiting for her outside, which you'll hear in this clip.
How you doing?
I'm done, baby.
Yeah?
I set up the Ed Board meeting with the Post on budget gains. I did an early briefing on the weak gluten import quota proclamation. We pardoned the turkey. I went to my dentist. I'm done.
So there are these two Indians in the lobby.
Yeah?
No, that's not the beginning of the joke. I'm saying there are these two Indians in the lobby.
I'm saying, yeah?
They had a meeting scheduled this morning with Jacob Cutler at Intergovernmental Affairs. Cutler had to cancel the meeting so he could see Northwestern border state governors to discuss porous borders between the U.S. and Canada. That's the governors of Washington, Idaho, North Dakota, Montana, and Alaska.
Yeah?
Yeah, well, apparently the Indians say they're not leaving until they get satisfaction.
How's this my problem?
CJ, there's two Indians sitting in the lobby. They say they're not leaving. There's press everywhere. I just made it your problem.
So aside from the extra information about the porous borders, that really is just filler for the show to show off, as it often does. CJ ends the discussion by saying, wow, Indians in the lobby on the day before Thanksgiving. That's ironic, sort of making the tongue-in-cheek joke that everyone's already thinking. She goes to the lobby where she finds said Indians, who I'm now going to properly start referring to as Native Americans. And they confirm that they're basically camping out so as to be inside of the press. The cold open then ends with Maggie Morningstar Charles, one of the Native Americans, confirming that this all has to do with, again, to quote CJ, us screwing you out of your land. We then go into the episode's various subplots, where Josh is tasked with handling a situation about an alleged teen murder suspect who has fled to Rome. He's at first confused about why the White House is involved in something that usually will be handled by the State Department, and then also confused about how to get home for Thanksgiving, having forgotten where his mother lives since he grew up in Connecticut, but she just bought a house in Florida. In the meantime, Sam and Toby are busy trying to figure out how to deal with suddenly having 4 million extra poor people on their hands, because the Office of Management and Budget is recommending a new model to calculate a poverty rate. They're stuck in a moral dilemma, since implementing the new model would help the quote-unquote newly poor apply for government assistance, but believe having so many extra poor people would look bad for the administration. So Toby goes to speak to President Bartlett about the communications for the calendar for the week. It calls for passing small and understandable pieces of legislation, which you would think would be like a home run, but the president's not super happy about it. Toby convinces him by citing some polling data, and then rather craftily distracts him by bringing up stuffing, as you'll hear here.
What kind of stuffing are we talking about?
Cornbread, oysters, water chestnuts, and andouille sausage.
You're going to cook on the inside or separate?
Inside?
Better make sure it cooks.
It'll cook.
If it doesn't cook, people are going to get sick.
It'll cook.
They'll be very, very sick.
I've got it covered. Anything else?
You know about the new OMB definitions?
I know they're coming out. What's it going to look like?
That depends. You want more poor people or fewer poor people?
Fewer poor people.
You got it. Thank you, Mr. President.
now Toby has both a policy direction and some breathing room because President Bartlett will be completely distracted for the rest of the episode, combining both the small policy idea and the stuffing obsession to come up with this genius idea.
If they want the nickel and dime stuff, I'll tell you one thing we can do.
What's that, sir?
This time of the year, there should be a hotline you can call with questions about cooking turkeys, a special 800 number where the phones are staffed by experts.
There is.
What do you mean?
The Butterball hotline.
Butterball has a hotline?
Yeah. It's an 800 number. The phones are staffed by experts.
Are you kidding me?
No.
God, I'm sorry. I love my country. Charlie, get me the number for the Butterball hotline.
Yes, sir.
So the president nicely out of touch.
I don't think this is the right one.
The right poll?
Yeah.
Was that it? Did I go too long? Sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
That made it sound like Jed Bartlett was interrupting you, though, which is awesome. Continue.
Sorry. So the president, nicely out of touch, he spends the rest of the episode basically waiting on hold of the Butterball hotline. Everyone is free to get actual work done. CJ continues to negotiate with the Native Americans and lobby, and she discovers they've been trying to get some paperwork processed for about 15 years without a response. So she gets rightfully, you know, incised on their behalf and goes back to her office where she tries to call a bunch of officials, except they are all out of the office for the holiday already. She tries to get Leo to take a meeting, but he refuses, sort of rightfully saying he's the chief of staff and he won't meet with anyone who's staging a sit-in in the lobby. But since it's not an Italian holiday, Josh is able to meet with someone from the Italian embassy. And that official basically schools him in regards to the death penalty, because the kid in question could face the death penalty for shooting his teacher in Georgia, the state, but the federal government outlaws the death penalty. So Josh is kind of caught in a moral quandary there, or legal quandary. He has no rebuttal, and he goes back to the White House to try to get some more clarity from Leo and figure out what's going on. So Leo basically verbally gives him some cliff notes why the situation is important, which you'll hear now.
Look,
wait.
I need to ask you something.
What?
What am I missing? Why does the White House care so much about an issue involving a local DA, which at best should be handled by justice and state and the embassy?
Because.
Because what?
Because I don't want this president to get a call from the Bishop of Rome.
Why do we care about the Bishop of Rome?
Because that's not the only name he goes by.
What's another name?
Your Holiness.
The Bishop of Rome is the Pope.
So Josh, finally having taken European Politics 101, tries to strategize with Leo about how to fix the situation, and the two basically decide to bribe the District Attorney of Georgia into agreeing not to pursue a death penalty in exchange for some financial help with his next election, even though that's not really legal. But Josh conveniently meets up with him in the Atlanta airport while on his way to Florida, despite having bugged Donna for the entire episode to get him a direct flight to Florida. He happily takes his layover, meets with the DA at a bar, and hands him an envelope full of names that will basically give him unlimited funding. So while all of that is going on, Toby catches up with Bruno to discuss how the new OMB model for poverty calculation will affect the election, but Bruno brushes off his concern like this.
Listen, the OMB is going to come out with a recommendation for a new way to calculate the poverty level.
Show of hands?
No, but the formula raises the poverty level 2,000 and change.
So what is it now?
20,000 a year. The problem is we got a campaign with 4 million new poor people.
That's the problem?
Yeah.
Not that someone making 21,000 a year is considered comfortable?
We're working on that one, too.
You keep working on that. I'll sell the other thing.
How?
Same way P.T. Barnum sold a truckload of white salmon, by sticking labels on them that said, guaranteed not to go pink, in the can. I have this fish theme going on today.
What the hell
are you telling me this formula's been broken for years and the other guys haven't fixed it? Like that. Want to get a quick drink?
No, I got nieces and nephews, and we'll meet Monday on this, okay?
Truckload of white salmon. You ever even heard of white salmon?
No.
Guy could sell anything.
So my personal love of P.T. Barnum's marketing skills aside, that story nicely sums up how everything that's been happening this whole episode is basically driven by misdirection and creative and questionable manipulating of positions to really drive the quote unquote, you know, moralistic resolutions that everyone's seeking. And it also provides more of the tongue-in-cheek exposition that really makes this episode a highlight. It's a little bit more self-aware than your typical episode. The icing on the cake comes next, which is when President Bartlett returns to the White House residence and he confronts his wife, Abby, about her reasoning for having Thanksgiving at Camp David. He tries to trick her into admitting that she chose the location based on polling information that he has inadvertently read while actually searching for the polling information about the minute legislation. But she quickly calls him out like so.
You can't be a father figure at Camp David?
I guess not.
This is ridiculous. You can't change plans on people the 11th hour.
It's no problem.
Of course it's a problem. When you're in the White House, there's an entire staff that has to be here. Now they can't go home.
It's their job.
It's Thanksgiving.
I've got polling numbers.
Which say Camp David is fine.
J'accuse.
Oh, brother.
J'accuse, mon petit fromage.
You speak four languages. How come none of them is French?
Something's wrong with my French.
You just called me your little cheese.
That's right.
They came to me. They said, what do you think about having Thanksgiving at Camp David instead of New Hampshire? They told me why. I said, fine.
And what part are you leaving out now?
The part where I lied to you.
Yes.
Yes, I do that sometimes. Sometimes I don't want to go 15 rounds on Bess Truman and what constitutes a farm. On your behalf, I have responded to polling information telling me what I should wear and what I should say, to say nothing of the fact that I have been subpoenaed to answer questions before Congress and how I secretly kept you alive. So explain to me now how what I did was out of line.
Abby, of course, is played by Stockard Channing, so really anytime she gets to put Jed in his place is pretty fantastic. And again, her dialogue here just really underscores how a lot of the altruism that the characters think they're abiding by is just sort of situational. And it provides a nice analogy to the way we're told to think of the first Thanksgiving as being this wonderful celebration of peace between the American settlers and the Native Americans. But it's probably just all propaganda that was at some point driven by polling data. to finally end the episode, CJ, finally out of options because security is threatening to forcibly remove the Native Americans in front of the press, goes back out to the lobby and tries one last time to get them to reschedule their original appointment, as you'll hear now.
How many treaties have we signed with the Munsee Indians?
Six.
How many have we revoked?
Six.
What were the Munsees doing in 1778?
Fighting in George Washington's army.
And why aren't you in New York anymore?
Because you marched us to Wisconsin.
And whose land was it in the first place?
Ours.
I'm going to have the park police escort you from the building. It'll take me a few minutes so you can make whatever calls you need to make. Or you can come back to my office right now. We'll make an appointment for Monday and the White House will cover your expenses.
Okay.
Okay, what?
Okay, ma'am.
No, okay, you're...
We'll come back to the office.
How do you keep fighting these smaller injustices when they're all from the mother of injustices?
What's the alternative?
And so with that, the episode comes to a close, ending on a fairly optimistic note, which is befitting given how everything has been neatly tied up in a bow with all the different subplots, despite the questionable moral detours and the double irony being that people always forget about the lessons of this episode because they go straight to the Butterball hotline clip, which, no surprise, I did not pull. You can Google that yourselves. Like everything else of Sorkin's, it's pretty heavy-handed when you look back at it, even though at the time it feels progressive. So that is why I chose it for the canon submission this week.
Joe, as a West Wing blogger, why don't you start us off?
Joe Reed, West Wing blogger. Yeah, I have some thoughts, as you can imagine. So this episode is sort of situated fairly interestingly for me. It comes right after an episode called Gone Quiet, which is one of my favorites, which is the one where Hal Holbrook shows up as this sort of like grumpy State Department official who Bartlett doesn't like. And it comes right before the episode The Women of Kumar, which is one that always gets sort of like elevated in status, but I didn't really like it. It was also pretty almost certainly the episode that was written, the first episode that was written after 9/11, because you can really tell where this is the one that Aaron Sorkin decided he was going to start addressing, like, the way the world is now. And, oh, did it go, like, and that's where sort of season three started to go, like, it had very high highs and low lows after that. This particular episode has two of my very favorite scenes in all of the history of the West Wing, one being the Butterball Hotline scene with Bartlett, and the fact that it's Toby in the room with him is so perfect. Yeah. He's such a great foil for that. And the way and the way he just sort of like...
of that is great.
And he'll like look at Bartlett and just be like, what now, my friend? Like, you've really written yourself into this corner. So that I really love. And the scene with Jed and Abby with the Mon Petit Fromage is always one that I go back to. Stalker Channing can be so delightfully hammy at times, and when she can really carry off a scripted or Sorkin scripted argument like that, you can just almost hear the like lilting in her voice. It's almost like she's singing it, and that kind of hamminess is irresistible to me. I think she's so funny. The rest of the stuff, I'm not quite sure how well Sorkin's sort of peppy rat-a-tat dialogue works with issues like decades of systematic genocide of Native American people. I think even with stuff like the title, like it's only called, the episode's only called The Indians in the Lobby so that they can like ring out those jokes about like, and a priest and a rabbi, like that kind of thing. Like even at that time, this was 2001. This was right after 9/11. Native American was fairly standard terminology. I feel like
it's been standard for like 20 years. Yeah. Seriously.
So like the title felt retrograde in a way that was effortful. Like it was really sort of like trying to have that sort of like hokey screwball kind of like whatever. That his tone works a lot better with something like the Bartlett and Abby scene, because that's actually a pretty interesting sort of a lighter spin. This episode is sort of in general a lighter episode, sort of a transitional episode. That scene gives you a little lighter spin on what had been and what would continue to be a serious storyline of Jed and Abby having these tensions over the continuing congressional investigation into him lying about MS. The thing about the Josh and the Italian storyline was kind of funny watching a storyline where the Italians were being held up as sort of more enlightened about criminal justice in this post-Amanda Knox world where it's just like, right, like that was interesting. Bruno, I think, is a really great character. Ron Silver is another very hammy actor, and it's sort of welcome in that context. I think, Stephanie, you made a very good point about how he allows a kind of more ruthless, pragmatic politics to enter into what is a very idealistic world. He's a really good contrast to them. I think that's definitely a good point. I think, Stephanie, you sort of ran into a double-edged sword with me in that I am very inclined towards the West Wing, but I have such a internal list of the episodes that I love and the episodes that I love a little less and the episodes that I don't love so much. So there are so many episodes that I would probably put canon worthy. This is more borderline for me. But the good parts in this really are so good. That Butterball Hotline is one of my top two or three scenes in any of the West Wing. It makes me laugh so much. And even being such like a product placey kind of like thing, I would love to find out what the chicken or the egg from that was,
yeah,
so to speak.
Totally.
Whether that was something that they wrote and then they were like, well, we got to get Butterball's permission, or whether like was that something like a native ad where Butterball is like, hey, we'll give you this money, see how you can fit it in.
Yeah.
Because they're so complimentary towards it, but I can totally see that being just like something that a writer, and it was probably one of his underlings, let's be honest, who then he, you know, Sorkin took credit for with the idea for the thing. But yeah, it's an episode with a lot of highlight moments for me.
Sarah.
You know, we always sort of debate at canon time. Is it quality or is it like exemplary? It's exemplariness. And Stephanie smartly said right up top that this does a lot of the things that the West Wing does, good and not good. Like, I just have to sort of subtract Josh from any assessment of the show that I make at this point, because he has aged so poorly for me. I find him a little more loathsome with every time I revisit this episode, but he's not so bad here. Although, of course, he's from Connecticut, the secretly suckiest state. Don't email me.
Wow. Shots fired at the nutmeg state.
I have been sitting in traffic in that state for most of this fucking week. And
that's
I'm
true.
Donezo. I'm more done than CJ. Yeah, I think this does have a lot of things that the show does well. This is a great episode for Toby. It's like classic Toby, sort of like micro eyebrow movements and just Phil Beharnd. Like, he's just genuinely curious as to where the fuck that came from.
King of Auto Sales in Fargo.
I also enjoyed Bruno Gianelli just ripping all the strips off Bartlett for the off-limits thing that he's like, let me explain to you a few things that are off-limits. Dickhead.
Even though that kelp analogy makes zero sense to me, and I've watched that episode
and it
20 times.
It goes on for a week. Yes. And I'm frankly not sure exactly what happens at the end.
No. I'm not sure anything does happen.
Let's just reiterate that Native Americans are continuing to get screwed. Is it just that, like, they finally were like, well, someone heard us. I guess we'll make a phone call? Like, that doesn't...
Right. The show kind of butts up against that a lot of the times, where it's at some point they can't change the way that the world is, so they just sort of feel like, well, we'll acknowledge this issue and sort of show where the dead end that politics comes to.
If only the best intentions were enough at this point. Yeah. Although at another point, sort of ironically, this is a line that's delivered very fast and not stood back from by Sorkin, where Leo is sort of like, you know, well, this is, I'm not negotiating with terrorists, basically. And she's like, well, it's a couple of Native Americans. I think we can take them. We always do. And it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Solid
yep.
point.
Nutshell.
I enjoyed revisiting it. I enjoyed how much the cast was enjoying themselves. It was nice to see, I'm a leftovers watcher. It's nice to see Donna up and around.
Speaking.
Yeah.
Talking. Slightly better haircut. I enjoyed this, but this really is, I think we do want to be voting on not just quality here, but like how this exemplifies what the West Wing does, whether or not there are things that we like. Tara.
A couple other things about Josh. It is not believable to me that he doesn't know who the Bishop of Rome is. Like, you're
yeah, right. What the hell?
That's
that
just
was such
stupidity.
A writerly. Yeah, that was so writerly. The fact that they needed to get Leo around to being able to make that revelation in three sentences rather
than
half.
And unless
the
guy's hiding in Vatican City, who cares? The Bishop of Rome can stand in line with everyone else who has a problem with it. Like, that was just a dumb show offy thing.
I mean, I assume the reason is because Bartlett is Catholic, and so that's why he would hear about it. But whatever. Like, that's not the point. If you're going to have him, like, just say the Pope, if that's your point, rather than have to make yourself seem smarter than the audience.
Leo.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's also a shame. I agree with you, Sarah, 100%, that the Josh character has not aged well, particularly since after the West Wing ended. Bradley Whitford has gotten to play so much more appealing comedic parts. He's such a good comic actor. Even in this, he's still good, even though the character is annoying. So it feels like a waste of his talents to see him doing this. But that said, I was really charmed by this episode. I don't think I had revisited it since I watched it when it first aired. Everything that Stephanie said about the Bruno character is totally right. He's really bracing. He's such a different energy. And he, as you said, you know, highlights the political realities of what they're trying to do in governance. Like, you can't just always be doing the, you know, pushing through the policy that makes you feel good, because that's not how the world works. Yeah. And you also can't, you can't decide you're too good and too principled to do this or that when it's going to, you know, as Abby says, it costs you nothing and it makes you more appealing to voters. Like, be reasonable. Don't just be stubborn for no good reason. The kelp analogy is dumb. I agree. But I loved the scene that Stephanie clipped with it, where he's having the conversation with, are you telling me this has been broken all this time and the other guys never fix it? Like, yes, exactly. Like, that's what's interesting to me about this show. And I admire your restraint, Stephanie, in not clipping the butterfly football hotline conversation, but I think that might have gone a long way to making some people's votes different, because that scene is so funny. It really is Aaron Sorkin at his best.
I have to say, when I went to watch it, so much of the visual reaction.
That's true. That is true. That's a good point.
Work.
Yeah.
They wait a while for that zip code.
Behind.
You really love
just,
that
line. I can't get past it. He really is just like saddened, but also curious. He's like, Bahard.
It's funny to me when Jed, because he thinks he's good at everything. Like, he has that dad quality. And when he has to find himself in a situation where he realizes, oh, I'm not a good improviser, like, that makes it even funnier to me. Exactly. So for me, like, that scene alone kind of makes this episode canon worthy. Like, it's so memorable, so funny, so winning. And, you know, leaving aside this, the stuff with the nomenclature, which is, I agree, problematic and, you know, open-ended, I do think this is an excellent choice for the canon, personally. Dave.
Not much to add. I will say that, you know, the inverse population of Ron Silver's to everybody else is actually probably truer to life in the White House.
No doubt.
But that show's probably Veep. I lost West Wing at that bullshit alternate universe 9/11 episode, which still, the thought of it makes me angry.
Me too.
That's Aaron Sorkin at its worst, you know, up to that point anyways, pre-newsroom and all that kind of stuff, but at his most indulgent anyways, and, you know, quick to put a pen to paper
and uninformed. Also,
I mean, thank God he doesn't have a show right now and the bullshit he'd be doing about the Paris stuff, you know, and immigration in Europe and all that kind of stuff.
We'll be getting to that in a moment.
So let's put this to a vote. Tara?
I vote yay.
I vote yay. Joe?
It's borderline. I realized that I would put a lot of West Wing episodes in the canon, so I'm going to say yes on this one.
All right, Sarah?
Yes for me.
Hey!
The West Wing, Season 3, Episode 8, Indians in the Lobby. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon and the Butterball Hotline Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
No.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Tara, what's our winner?
Well, carrying through the theme that we started with Project Runway Jr. and paused on again for Sarah's Around the Dial entry with MasterChef Jr. Today, this week's winner is DJ Arch Jr., the 3-year-old DJ who just won South Africa's Got Talent. Please Google this child. It is so cute to see him behind his decks. I have no problem with any part of this. Good job, DJ.
Oh my God, adorable.
Loser?
In keeping with the West Wing theme, that would be Mr. Rob Lowe. Oof. Snarky tweets directed at the president of France after the attacks in Paris on Friday night could have been more tone deaf. But you really don't get to bitchily workshop the quality of the man's speech when people are still looking for loved ones. You aren't Sam Seaborn. You aren't French. Nobody fucking asked you. So in the words made famous by one of your Brat Pack mates, you and all your fellow famous people can just stick to the things you know. Shopping, nail polish, your father's BMW, your poor, rich, drunk mother in the Caribbean.
Shopping.
Guys, you know what time it is? Escape time. Time.
Also acceptable.
All right, everybody, this is the fifth game time of this season. Tara has 2 points, Joe and Value Guess each with one. Sarah still looking to get on the board. Today, we are playing The Return of the Mountain Climber. from Teresa, who explains, this is an offshoot of Joe's superb game time submission from episode 60. There are 64 questions in which the answer is a number. Players will guess as close to the number as possible. The further away from the correct answer, the more points you get. And to win, you have to have the least points at the end of the game.
Okay.
A bullseye answer, if you recall, allows you to subtract 10 points from your score.
Oh, shit.
All right. And she notes, small and large questions have been spaced out, so no one is at an inherent disadvantage. Make sense?
Key.
Yes.
Are we ready? All right, let's start with the piggy.
We will start with valued guests.
All right, so let's go. Value guest, Sarah, Joe, Tara. Make sense?
Yes.
Here we go.
Got it.
Yep.
All right. Round one. The average age of opening credits cast in the show's first seasons. I'm going to give you the show. You give me the average age of that cast from the first season. And okay. I think, how are we going to do the score? You keep a track, Tara, or does everybody need to keep track of their own here?
Everyone probably should keep track of their own just okay. in case, but yes, I will.
Okay. So, your show, Stephanie, is That 70s Show. What do you think the average age of the first season opening credits cast is?
Well, Mila Kunis brings it down, but I'm going to say 25.
25. I'm going to give you a within five ding ding. The answer is 30. So you get 5 points for that answer. All right.
Nicely done. I thought it would be more because of the parents, but maybe they weren't cast.
I said Joe second, correct?
Sarah second.
Sarah second.
Sarah then Joe.
Roseanne.
Credits cast of Roseanne.
Yeah, average age.
Average age.
First season.
Season one.
Mm.
Oof.
Mm-mm. 31.
23.
Wow.
That gets you 8
That little
points.
One was really little.
Yeah. Happy days, Joe. Monday, happy Tuesday.
They weren't all happy right. days.
I'm going to say 36.
35.
Shit.
Whoa.
Nice. Nicely done.
Tara.
Yeah.
Gilmore Girls.
Oh.
There's Dad Gilmore in there.
Yeah,
I
know.
Right?
Yep,
I think
he was.
The last guy in the
He
credit.
Definitely was.
I don't know. Why
I'm
am I saying this?
I'm going to say 38.
37.
Yeah!
Nice. Hey.
All right, we're back to Stephanie. Dawson's Creek, where it all began.
They're kind of older, so 21.
Get this, 32.
Jeez.
Wow.
32.
Oh,
yeah, the Sarah, the OC.
The OC. 30.
31.
Nice.
Everybody's getting within one of the answer when they get close. Smallville, Joe.
All right, is there anybody old in the Smallville cast? Like, really old?
Well, Superman's kind of old.
No helping.
He was flying around space. Well, I guess the actors. We're talking actors, not characters.
I'm going to say 27.
Guess what? 28.
Nice.
Oh,
28.
Wow.
All right.
Rhymony.
Tara.
Me, yep.
X-Files. First season of the X-Files.
Oh, hmm.
Tricky.
Yeah. I don't even remember who else was in the opening credits other than the two of them.
I think of, well, I don't want to say.
I don't, yeah, no, I'm not fishing.
Can't give you any more information, Tara.
I understand. I'm gonna aim low and say 29.
That is our first bullseye.
What?
Hey, good job.
I think it was just those two.
I guess it must have been.
Yeah.
And that alien.
All right, so what is what happens
negative
now?
Negative 10. You take 10 points off your score.
All right.
All right.
Nice.
Back to Stephanie. The Office. Yeah. And I'm going to assume we're talking U.S. Office here.
That young. They weren't that. They were kind of their own ages. So... Jay Novak was like a baby at that point, right? So maybe 32.
33!
Nice!
You
guys are getting so close when you get close. Boy Meets World. Boy Meets World for Sarah.
Really?
Oh, picky. Oh. Screwed up.
Nice.
This was supposed to go to Stephanie.
Seriously. 22.
What's your guess, Stephanie, just out of interest?
For Boy Meets World?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember if Mr. Feeney was in the credit. I'd probably go 18.
Oh, Sarah was actually closer, 27, so I'm
nice.
Guessing he was in there. So that's within 5 points. We'll give you a ding. You guessed 22, right?
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah. Gossip Girl, Joe.
Gossip Girl. these sort of newer, more recent credits where they don't show everybody's photo in the credits, so it's hard to remember who was actually in them, is a little tougher.
Also, I think these days teenagers are played by older and older and older people.
Very true. I'm going to say 24.
23.
Wow.
Ooh. Nice.
Tara.
Yeah.
Law and Order original Ray's recipe.
Damn it.
Fuck.
And we'll check in with Sarah before we reveal the answer.
Yeah, no, of course.
So start thinking of your answer, Sarah.
If you weren't going to, I would have. I'm going to say... Fuck me. I'm going to say 44.
And Sarah, what
Sarah,
would
you
say?
Sarah, what would you say?
I would say 42 because of Stephen A. Hill.
Right.
Bullseye, 44.
I really?
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. Good for you.
Tara, you must have negative points now.
I do.
It really was
so many negative
points. Holy shit.
Oh, my God.
All right. Boy meets... Girl meets world. Girl meets world. And this is for Steffi.
This is picky. Picky lucked out for you.
Wait, this one's for me?
Yep.
Yeah.
This is nice. Girl meets world.
All right, so they're like in there.
So we have already had the mind game of getting it wrong on Boy Meets World. Yeah. How have the shows changed? How scared of is she of her 18?
Wait, I'm
answer?
Doing actual math now, though. This is hard. So Rowan's like 13.
An apology to the listeners that you didn't know there was math involved.
I'm going to just go 21.
20.
Wow.
20. Ooh,
well done.
All right, Sarah is your last of this round. Cheers. Cheers. Season one.
Cheers. Season one.
Explain to the good folks what was different from season one from other seasons that may affect this.
I know something. I don't really know.
Okay.
I'm just going to be guessing like right. I've been doing throughout.
All right.
And I will go with 34.
39. Don't forget, this is Coach. Or not Coach. It's Coach? What's his name?
Oh, yeah, Coach.
Coach. Coach. Yeah, so he's going to bring that that average up before he's replaced by Woody.
And then die.
Yes.
Yeah.
As all people do. Joe, prison break.
Thank you.
Prison break for Joe.
Prison break even have credit?
Prison break was a show.
It was. It was the first show I ever recapped for.
Is that true?
Roll Twop. Yeah.
Good
I
lord.
Did a fill-in.
Is it?
Yeah. Hey, Fick was on it. Show
but they're bringing
it.
They're bringing it back, aren't they? They're doing a miniseries
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, they are. They're doing yes. like
are they
a
really?
Prequel.
Yeah.
Yes. They're both on Flash right now. Those two, or I guess they're both guest stars. On
Stop
Flash.
Talking.
Anyway,
yeah.
I'm stalling like crazy here. 40.
36. 36. Ah. Last question of this round for Tara. Step by step.
Ooh, baby.
Hmm. 35.
28. All right, here we are at our first score break. Let's hear them score, Sarah.
Okay. I have negative 12.
Okay.
Joe has 7. Stephanie has 16. Sarah has 19. Does that sound right for what you guys have been keeping track of?
Yep.
Okay, good.
Yep.
All right.
Very good.
Very good. Back to round two. You're guessing the number of television and TV movie producer credits for the following people.
Wow.
All right.
Okay.
And we're starting with
Stephanie,
who has Tina Fey.
Oh, man.
Tina Fey, what? Number of producer credits for television shows and TV movies.
TV, okay, that's different. TV movies. I'm gonna go with 4.
5.
Nice.
Well done.
Recent canon inductee Aaron Sorkin is for Sarah.
For Sarah.
Aaron Sorkin, Sarah.
Yep, I heard you.
All right. Aaron.
And TV movies?
Sorkin.
That's really weird. 7.
5.
Nice.
Amy Schumer for Joe.
Amy Schumer.
Yeah.
TV show and TV movie.
Yeah. Producer credits on
two?
Those.
2.
4. 4. Allison Sweeney.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. 3.
Bullseye.
What?
Yeah. Yep.
Jesus Christ.
All right, back really? To Stephanie. Rob Thomas. Rob Thomas.
Oh, man.
Man's been around.
Five.
12.
Wow.
12. Wow.
Yeah. Amy Sherman Palladino. For Sarah.
Amy Sherman Palladino. 4.
8. Vince Gilligan. Or Joe.
Okay. Vince Gilligan. How long has he been around? 5.
7. Ugh. Michael Schur. Sure?
Yeah.
Oh, he did, well, I guess I shouldn't say.
6.
He's a Brooklyn Nine-Nine
guy.
Yeah,
he's the Brooklyn Nine-Nine guy.
7. Very close. 4, Stephanie, Shonda Rhimes.
Oh, man.
Her evil twin.
Yeah. She's got a hell of a goatee, guys. Shonda Rhimes.
Big 3, I'm wondering how many bad TV movies she's written. Make it 6.
20.
Yeah.
Whoa.
20. Yeah.
That's a
Greg
lot
Berlanti.
Of
Greg Berlanti.
Oh my
for Sarah.
God. He's like just on TV right now.
Seriously.
18.
20.
Nice, Sarah.
Nice job.
I was going to say
Donald
20.
Belisario. Donald Belisario, Joe.
Okay.
I could picture the font, but I don't know where it was.
19.
Belisario? He's yeah. 80s stuff, I think, right?
No, he's Jag.
Yeah.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry, what did you guess, Joe?
18. Oh, 19.
15.
Well
15.
Done.
Chuck Lorre. Or Tara.
Oh, boy.
He's got his mitts on some stuff.
Yeah, he's got a lot of mitts on a lot of stuff. I'm going to say 19.
15. 15. All right, everybody's last question for round two, starting with Stephanie. Jerry Bruckheimer.
Fuck.
Jeez. 15.
Ooh. 42.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
This is going to take a second, guys. Okay,
that
so 15.
That is an impressive
Sarah.
Contract that man has.
Sarah.
Yeah.
Dick Wolf.
Oh, my God. Oh, shit.
Dick Wolf.
Uh-huh.
Hmm.
Done neat. Some stuff.
22.
Ooh. 40.
Fuck.
40.
Hold on a second, because this is taking me a lot of hash marking time.
It's okay. Well, it's not your turn yet, so
I'm keeping backup Tara for you just in case.
All right, Joe. Gary Marshall.
Oh,
Gary Marshall.
Gary Marshall.
She's a boy. Thank you,
Gary Marshall. Let's say
Gary Marshall. 38. 23 is the answer. 15-point spread. All right, Tara. Need a little time? Should I vamp?
Nope, go ahead.
Tara.
Yes.
Running out round two.
Yep.
J.J. Abrams.
Oh, fuck.
TV Jesus. And TV
the Jerry Bruckheimer of shows
credits.
That are good for a while.
Well, it's also producer credits.
Yeah, no, I know.
So he's got a lot of shit in that column.
I know. Oh, God.
Well, maybe he has a little shit in that column. Who's to say?
25.
20. 20.
Wow, nice.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, let's hear them scores.
I have negative 12.
Yep.
Joe has 30.
Yeah.
Does that sound right? Okay. Sarah has 20, 45. Stephanie has 20, 40, 60. 75.
Oh.
That Jerry Bruckheimer one was a real heartbreaker.
In there.
All right, we're flipping the script for round three. Average age of the opening credits cast in the show's last season.
Oh!
Last season.
Okay.
All right, so a little tricky. We're going to start with Stephanie. Guess what? The West Wing.
Oh, man. Martin Sheen was kind of old.
Here's what I can tell you about the difference between round one and round three. Is that people in the last season are older than the first season. So keep that in mind when you're doing your math.
That's a good hint.
Yeah.
Good job. 48.
Bullseye.
Nice.
Yay.
Sarah, wings. Wings.
Oh, Christ. Don't mean the hair.
Keep in mind the show was on for about 82 seasons somehow.
It is still on somewhere. There's some, like, in the fringe alternate universe.
Yeah.
It's still going on and they still have the same hair.
What's-her-face is still pitching Crystal Pepsi. Crystal yeah. Bernard?
Oh yep, Crystal
her,
Bernard.
What happened to her?
She's
like eaten by a bear?
She's in the Pepsi zone. It's like the Phantom Zone, see. But just for Pepsi pitch people.
For crystals? Yeah.
Yeah.
40.
I'm glad you put it up there. 44.
Nice.
44. Nice. Joe, Charmed. Last season of Charmed. Enters, exits, getting older. They're witches, though. Keep that in mind.
That's true. This is true.
Dave from the Making Own Fun department.
Sorry. I don't think there were any people bringing up the top end of that age, so I'm going to say they were 34.
30.
Well done.
Roswell.
Tara.
28. Oh, ooh. Good guess. Saved by the Bell, Stephanie. You're getting all the teen tween shows. Saved by the Bell. Last season.
Not the college years.
Saved by the, I don't know. I assume that's
that was
a different show.
So that's okay. probably high school.
Yeah.
23.
Well done.
23. Nice. Sarah, sister. sister, he says.
Keep in mind, Jack Hay is ageless.
Speaking of witches.
I'll find it because I don't want to be killed. I've never seen the credits of any season of that show, so let's take a flyer on 29.
31. Close.
Nice. Well guessed.
All right.
Good flyer.
Wow. Well
Joe,
flied.
Law & Order Mothership last season.
Ooh.
We had first season. Now we have last season.
So there's only 6 cast members. Anthony Anderson? Was he last season of that show? Who were the...
Cannot provide you any information.
Roach wasn't that old. Sam Waterston was. Carrie the One. And Square Root of 9. I'm going to say... 42.
So the first season was 44. The last season, 47.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah. Dang.
All right, Tara.
Yep.
Star Trek Next Generation.
Oh, okay.
Who was in the last season? Makes a big difference to the age.
Oh, yeah. That
I'm going to say 40.
Good guess. 43. Wesley was gone by then. So. Veronica Mars. Veronica Mars for Stephanie. Ooh, 27.
Oh, nice.
Still a good guess.
Sarah, Laverne and Shirley, last season.
Oh, my God.
Average age.
The last season.
500.
Seriously. Well, if you subtract the big ragu. Just kidding. Oh, jeez.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Who the hell was in the opening credit? Guess what? Bullseye.
Wow.
Yay. Thank God.
All right, Felicity, Joe.
Okay. All right.
Sounds like a name of a Western show. Felicity Joe.
Felicity Joe. He marched on into town. Okay.
Cut everyone's hair.
With Betty White on the set. Just kidding.
All right.
So last season of Felicity.
Just out of college in the show.
Then there's time travel. You have to subtract 6.
It's true. I don't think there were too many adults in the...
Not too many adults.
28.
That is close enough. 32. Star Trek, the original series.
Oh, fuck. Well, they didn't age that much from the beginning to the end, but that doesn't help me because we didn't find that one out in the first round. 39.
42, which is a year less than Star Trek Next Generation. Interesting, is it not? Everwood. For Stephanie, last question for everybody. Ooh. In round three.
Ooh. I think the kids were really actually almost their age in that show. So, 26.
39 was the average age of the cast.
What was it, 29?
The grandma.
39, yeah. Growing pains, Sarah. Growing pains.
Growing
last season.
Pains. Oh, Christ. Mm. That fool, and then that other fool, and then the cousin Oliver.
What do you got?
29.
25.
Wow.
Joe, My So-Called Life. Average age last season.
No.
Yo. Sad. A lot of those kids were actually high school age-ish.
Yeah, Claire Danes was a baby.
Yeah. And then there was Graham and Patty bringing that average up a bit. I'm going to say 25.
Oh, 24.
Oh,
nice.
Last question of this round for Tara. The Wonder Years.
Okay. Are we counting Joe Cocker, or he wasn't actually in the cast? I'm just joking.
He was the Vonda Shepherd of the Wonder Years.
Oh, God. Not a paper route.
31.
27. 27. All right, let's hear them scores.
Okay, I have -1.
Yep.
Joe has 24.
Uh-huh.
Sarah has 25. Stephanie has...
Sarah and I are 44 and 45.
Yes, you are.
By my count.
I can't count is the problem. So Stephanie has 20, 40, 60, 70, 81.
Okay. Sometimes things happen in game time. All right.
Jerry Bruckheimer happened to Stephanie.
I think this is a chance for bullseyes. That's what this round is about.
Okay.
It's not going to be a large point spread. It's going to be about knocking points off your score if possible.
Everyone put on your rally caps because Dave just jinxed everybody.
Hope it's possible.
The topic of round four is the year of the first season of the following shows.
Oh.
All right.
Okay.
So chances are it's going to start with 19 or 2000 something.
Yep.
Starting
are
with
we talking
Stephanie,
about television? I think you're right.
The Brady Bunch.
For Stephanie.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. The year the Brady Bunch started.
Did it ever start and did it ever end? 19... God.
I'm going to give you a hint. So far, you're right.
Yes. I'm going to split the difference of what's going on in my head. 1965.
Ooh.
69. Yeah. All right. Sarah, Ed.
Oh.
Ed.
Ed. 1998.
2000.
Ooh.
Joe, Spin City.
Okay, Spin City.
That is how you pronounce it.
The City of Spin.
Yeah.
I'm trying to triangulate when he announced his Parkinson's and back date from that.
Should have done some math calculation noises.
Okay, I'm going to say
that was good.
1996.
Ooh, you're... 4 years off. 2000. Sorry. 19. Oh, I'm reading the wrong one. Guess what? Bullseye.
What?
Yes.
I was reading Ed. Nice. I was looking at the answer for Ed. Spin
what was
City.
It? 95?
96.
96.
Yep.
Well done.
So that's
Joe.
-10 for Joe.
Good
for
job.
Tara.
Yeah.
Your show, ER.
This one is 1994.
Bullseye. Bullseye, I Love Lucy for Stephanie.
Jesus, Picky.
Picky, you fucking bitch.
That's some bullshit.
That's right. You're all getting bullshit shows for this.
Stephanie, I Love Lucy was a show.
Yeah.
I love Lucy. I just don't know when she started.
Keep in mind, it's black and white.
1954.
Close, 51. Good
well
guess.
Done. Nice.
Gilligan's Island.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, I told you you're all getting.
1965.
Oh, 64.
No.
Oh.
Green Acres, Joe.
Oh, come on.
Sheepers. Okay, Green Acres. My recollection was that it was.
Joe, sing the theme for 5 day points. Go.
Green Acres is the place to be. Farm living is a life for me.
Great.
Da, 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 so yep. Far and wide. Da, 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 give me the countryside. Bye.
All right, 5 points. Right
okay,
down.
Sweet. All right. As for the
D points noted.
Dance monkey.
I'm marking down my goddamn D points. So
all right, I marked them down too.
The question is the
year
debut for Green Acres. That was fun.
59.
Ooh. 65. Yeah.
Ugh.
Tara's horseshit answer. Bewitched. I mean, question. Bewitched.
1965.
64. 64, 1 year off. All right, back to Stephanie. Getting the least bullshitty one of this round, I think. Caroline in the City.
Debatable.
Oh, my God.
Bullshitty to me.
Bullshittiness is measured in ability to guess somewhat accurately.
Yeah, I feel like I would get...
Some of these are like, what decade was that?
I feel like I've seen an episode of this, so that's a start.
Oh, you're the one.
96.
Ooh, 5. 95. Good guess, though.
Good guess.
All right, Sarah. The Andy Griffith Show. Now you can whistle it for 5 day points if you want. That's good for 5 day points. All right. What year?
Oh, you actually want a year as
yeah,
well?
Yeah.
I didn't know you were that good at whistling.
But I'm going to... Yeah, I didn't either. I'm going to say 1957.
1960. 60. All right, Tara.
Nope. Joe.
Yes. Who is like Tara in many ways.
Yep.
Dallas. We're talking original Dallas.
Right. Oh, Dallas remake would have been better. Yeah. Okay. Original Dallas. Okay. Bastion of 80s soapdom, but did it start even earlier than that? I don't know. 1980.
You're on the right track. 78. It did start a little earlier than its peak. For sure. Tara.
Mm-hmm.
The Munsters.
Okay.
And not the exciting remake from 2 years ago.
Oh, God. Yes.
Mocking Turd Lane.
God, it was so bad. I'm going to stick with 65.
Ooh, 64. Damn. Very close. All right, here comes everybody's last questions. A little more doable.
Okay.
For Stephanie. Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Piggy really is giving you all these sort of teen-tween shows. The exception of that first one. So you're...
And I Love Lucy.
Yeah, that was a big teen show. Sabrina the Teenage Witch. What year did it start? Still there, Stephanie?
Is she there?
No, I don't hear.
Oh, no.
She's, yeah, she's...
I can hear something, but I can't
hear
speech.
Stephanie, can you plug your mic out, then back in?
Oh.
Are you there?
You're sounding pretty silent-y to us.
Okay, I'll call back.
Hello?
Bye.
Did you hear what Tara got on that last one? Because I didn't.
The Munsters.
No, but did you hear what?
No, I didn't hear.
Okay, yeah, I didn't
hear. Hello.
Hello,
Stephanie. Okay, there we go. All right.
Make sure that she starts a new recording if she unplugged her mic.
Yeah, is your recording still going?
My recording, yeah.
Still going? Okay.
Tara, what did you get on that last one? Because I didn't hear it.
I was 1 year off.
Okay, thanks.
All right. So I'll just start again with Stephanie's question. So.
Thank you.
Stephanie, Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Okay. So Harvey was in the credits, if I remember correctly. 35.
Was the cat in the credits?
No, it's the year it started.
Oh, the year. Oh, that's right. Wrong round.
I'm sorry. That answer, we're going to have to accept that.
The year
you
35.
You just lost so many points.
1995.
96. Very close. All right, Sarah, your last question. The year Cheers started. Cheers.
82.
Bullseye.
Yeah. Hey!
Family Matters for Joe.
Oh.
Ooh, okay. Was such a tweener then. Okay. I'm gonna choose. Jesus. All right. 1990. Oh, God, I don't want to pull the trigger on something to be wrong. 1991.
89. All right, last question of the game for Tara. Perfect Strangers.
Cousin.
Oh, excuse me.
1986.
Bullseye.
Wow.
All right, that's the end of the game. Let's hear the scores.
Okay, well, I have negative 19. Joe has, Sarah has 41. Joe has 44. Stephanie has 90.
All right.
Congratulations, Tara.
There was a tiebreaker, but I don't have the answer handy, so I'm going to read the question and go read my email quick to find out what it is, all right? And hopefully it'll all work out. So your tiebreaker is, I'm going to give you a little time to think about it. The number of TV and TV producer credits for Aaron Spelling.
Oh my God. Dang.
Mother, okay.
Yeah, so that's got some mustard behind it.
I'm going to say like 60.
All right, Tara's in at 60.
That's probably low because TV movies.
TV movies and TV shows.
That's a good point.
Producer credits, yeah.
I'm going to go 73.
Okay.
I'm going to go
find out the answer.
52.
All right, Stephanie, what do you think?
65.
All right, so our answers were 65.
60.
60.
52.
And?
73.
Yeah. 73 wins it as the closest. And when I say closest, I mean the answer is 225.
Oh my God.
God bless that man. He just gave and gave.
He did.
Sure did.
So how many Dave points does Sarah get for that?
Oh, Sarah gets, Aaron says, let's say 25.5. We're going to divide that by 10.
Very nice.
Tara. All right, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Gray. Very quickly, what's happening on the site?
There's everything's happening on the site.
Good
what
answer.
Isn't happening? Sorry, all I was right. doing math.
You weren't prepared. All right, that's fine. Go to previously.tv. We got lots of coverage of Project Runway Juniors. We got some old West Wing stuff. Interesting note, the Bartlett Butterball speech did not win one day on King of the Mountain on the site. It went up against David Letterman's Taco... Bell Taco drive-in skit.
Oh,
and
that
lost.
Is a good one. Yeah. I do have something for the site. We're starting our coverage of Jessica Jones, the Netflix show, on Friday, November 20th. We will have a new post every day other than the Thanksgiving long weekend. So check those out. We're going in order with a huge cast of characters contributing.
All right. All right. That is it. We discussed the so what of Project Runway Jr. Pause for laughs. Before going around the dial with stops at Peep Show, The Man in the High Castle, How to Get Away with Murder, MasterChef Jr., Into the Badlands, and with Bob and David. A whole bunch of other stuff happened, but I forgot to write the rest down, so...
We're listening.
I am David, Incomplete Notes Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano...
Button Bag.
Sarah D. Bunting.
crying cut ankle biters.
Joe Reed.
Chuck Hughes.
And Stephanie Kangro.
Et petit fromage.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grate.
It's the brine that keeps the meat soft, lady. You soak it overnight in water, salt, sugar.
17 kinds of...
17 kinds of spices, including...
anise and coriander.
Now you can go.
Thank you, Mr. President.